Vanderdice. My wife's here sitting in the second row, named Sharon, and we have three lovely children. And we came back from Papua New Guinea in the middle of last year to have our youngest baby. His name is Lauren, and she's just over a year old now. Now we're currently, or just about to be, recommended by the Christian Community Church up in Rockhampton. We were originally commended for a 2-year term, but when we go back again early next year, we'll be commended as career members of Wycliffe. So we're support workers with Wycliffe Bible Translators. And I just want to mention a couple of things about Wycliffe's vision. And the vision is to translate the Bible into the heart language of all people who need it in every part of the world. So it's quite a big vision. And at the moment, there are about a bit over 1,500 translates and projects underway, and 2,200 completed New Testaments worldwide. Now, just to talk a little bit about Papua New Guinea, and it has over 800 of those languages, so it's a place that it's only a small place comparatively, even compared to Queensland, but the number of languages that are there and the variety that's up there is absolutely phenomenal. So you can see it for yourself, the needs that are up there. 140 of the languages have a completed New Testament. There is still a lot of work to do. I'm sure Bill Callister later on will talk a little bit about what it's like to actually be a translator and do that work. And I've just got a little question there that we can think about. Where would we be without the Bible? Simple, straightforward question, isn't it? And we do take it for granted. But a lot of people in Papua New Guinea don't have a Bible. Now, first of all, I need to explain that I'm not a translator. I come under the category of a support worker. My wife and I are support workers. And I want to just encourage you to realise how important support workers are. Where we live, up at a little place called Ukarumpa in the Eastern Highlands province of Papua New Guinea, probably about a third of us are actually what you'd call support workers. And without these people, the translators and the missionaries have a great difficulty doing what they need to do. And this fact was really brought home to me once when I was talking to one of the old missionaries who'd been up there since the 1960s. And he just said to me, he came over for dinner, and he just said to me, "Craig, we're so grateful that people come up to teach our children," even though his children had long left. Because he said, when I first came out here as a translator, I would go out to the village maybe for 3 months and work on translation. And I'd just be getting going with that. And then for the next 3 months, I'd have to come back and work on building houses for 3 months. And then there's a lot of children up there as well, so I have to spend a few months teaching children. And then finally, I got back around to doing some translation again. So his New Testament was dedicated not that long ago, but it took a long time. The translators' hearts are to be translating. That's what God's called them there for. And it just relieves the situation so much when we can have people up there doing the support roles to fill in those gaps. Wycliffe has a vision to see a translation begun in every language by the year 2025. And you might think to yourself, well, that's a long way off. But it's not really, because it equates to about half the world's languages. And if you think about it, in one way it's taken 2,000 years to translate half the world's languages, and not just Wycliffe, mind you, but all the different agencies that Wycliffe works together, a lot of agencies, the aim to get the other half done in 25 years, quite phenomenal. So that's a big thrust at the moment to get translations for these people. Talk a little bit about some of the things that support workers do. We have a clinic up where we live, which is very, very useful. I've had to use it on numerous occasions. I don't know why I get more sick when I'm up there, but it just happens. And so we've got some quite good doctors. They look after the nationals as well as the translators and the support workers up at Ikarumpa. When somebody gets very sick, they get flown off to Cairns. And this is a translator here who's hurt his back, and he's on his way to Cairns. And that really is quite good. We've got aeroplanes up there that can do all that, so we've even got a helicopter. All those kinds of things are very important. To get anywhere in Papua New Guinea, if you're not going by plane, you need a four-wheel drive. You need cars. So we have to have people there that are mechanics and can keep cars and all those sort of things going. You can see the grader in the background. If we don't grade the roads up there, we can't drive on them. Pilots, very important. This young lady's just come back from Australia. She's had a baby. And if you have pilots and you have planes, you need a whole host of people that are going to look after those planes. At the moment, well, actually, just recently, we built a primary school inside Ikarumpa, and these guys are actually building it, so we need builders and carpenters and people like that out there too. Okay, now a bit down to closer to what we actually do up there. Because in view of the fact that we had two kids while up there, now we've got three, Sharon spends a lot of her time with the kids, which is obviously very important. Our kids are only young. But she did manage to get away one day a week, and she called this her rest and relaxation. She got to work in the director's office. So that was really good for her. She also was quite involved with Bible studies and leading Bible studies amongst all the other expats who are up there. It's quite a ministry to other people from all the other countries up there as well, because often you find, and Sharon would say, particularly for the ladies, you know, they might be struggling quite a lot because their husbands sometimes can be quite tied up in translation, or they may even be away in a village for a prolonged period of time. So it's quite a ministry just to other ladies, and that's something that Sharon, my wife, is very interested in. Now, when I was up there, I worked at the high school, and when I go back, that's what I'll be doing too. I'm a chemistry and biology teacher, and also do a bit of math too. Nothing too complicated though. This is a picture of the high school from the air. You can see a large oval, and over on the left hand side, that rectangular sort of area of buildings, that's really the high school there. The high school probably has I think it's around about 200 students. I'm using very rough figures here, but so the high school, that's me trying to teach. I had to teach the New South Wales curriculum, which was fairly entertaining for me because I come from Queensland, grew up in Brisbane, and the New South Wales curriculum, when I arrived there in the year 2000, they had decided that they wanted to change the syllabus or the curriculum for every single subject in grade 11 and 12 in the same year. And I arrived right at the beginning of that, and they said, "Oh, you're Australian, you can do that." And it was quite hard. It was very hard because I had two new subjects, chemistry and biology, and they had really changed the curriculum. they hadn't just made some little modifications, they'd actually changed the whole angle at which they were teaching. They had completely different emphasis to what they had before. So that was quite difficult, and that coupled with the fact that, of course, if you change the curriculum in 1 year, it takes the people who write textbooks quite a while to catch up. So the whole thing started off without any textbooks and anything like that. The only thing I felt good about was that everybody in New South Wales, all the teachers were going through the same thing that I was. But yeah, it was difficult. So I've got these students from all over the world. It's about, and this is rough again, there's about 17 nationalities in Papua New Guinea. In Ukarumpa, where we are, from all over the place. So you can even see the port where they put their bags, and every bag has a different flag just to show how much of a multicultural sort of a place it is. So I had a great time teaching these kids. This is some primary school kids. Primary school's a little larger. Just been relocated onto the centre where we are. All the students do the same sorts of things. I was quite surprised. They do much the same sort of things that we do here. They play the sport against the other national schools around. We compete against other national schools and do all sorts of fun things like that. Sometimes our students get very carried away. One particular day, a bunch of grade 8 girls started to chase me, and I was a little bit concerned. I got even more concerned when I thought, oh, well, what could grade 8 girls do to a teacher? I soon found out, because they pulled out some real handcuffs, and they tied my back, hands behind my back with real handcuffs. And they actually got 4 of us teachers. And you might see that one of them looks a little bit wet, his shirt's been wetted. Actually, a couple of them. Well, that's because they also had water pistols. And what they were doing was trying to raise money for 40-hour famine. And their idea of raising money was, if you can get someone to pay us money, we'll let you out of your handcuffs. So that's the kind of rascal activity I don't mind too much. Okay, so you can see we've got a whole lot of needs up there besides translators. And it was quite interesting listening to Armin just before because, teachers are in such demand. I met just probably 2 or 3 weeks ago, I met a man who was up in Egypt, and he was also working with these disabled people had some amazing things to say about how people don't get out of their little family groups, and because of this, there's sort of an inbreeding that people are actually more disabled. And he was working with those people, and I could see his heart was not here in Australia while he was talking to me. I could just see in his eyes he wanted to be back there. And I said, well, you know, why are you here at the moment? He said, well, we didn't have a high school up there that I could take the children to, our kids to, and they needed to do high school. And I thought, oh. Yeah, that made me think, you know. It really made me think. So we need to get this idea of missionaries as just being going and preaching the gospel and just going being translators. We need to remember that there's a whole host of other people that need to go out there as well. Then again, there's even more than that. There's the people back here that support by prayer and finances and encouragement. Keep you in touch, being interested in visiting and showing hospitality and sending gifts. I just wonder, you know, something the Lord's been speaking to me about is when I pray for other missionaries or when I support other missionaries, is it a case of, oh, okay, I've got, you know, you can, if you want to send money to a missionary, you can sort of put it on your card and it's all done electronically, and you don't even have to think about it. And, you know, we had some people that we support in that sort of way, and you know, you're sort of detached. You can get very detached, and when I started really getting concerned about Muslims, because a lot of people have been talking about Muslims lately. It's really an area of interest, and I thought, well, look, at the moment, you know, the Lord's not calling me to a Muslim place, but But, you know, what should my reaction be? Now, you might think, why am I talking about this? Well, I think this is all of us. You know, we're here in Australia at the moment, or wherever, in Papua New Guinea or whatever. We still want to pray for other missionaries. But how do we think about them? Do we really get involved and really pray and really think about how they're coping, and are we really concerned about it? Or is it just a matter of sending money, you know? There was a little story, I don't know how true this is, but of Mother Teresa, who this man came up to her and offered her millions of dollars, and she said, no, I'm not interested in your money. She said, but if you came along, that'd be great, you know. So, you know, our involvement needs to really be on a spiritual and emotional level, and not just well, obviously finances, you need them, but that's not the big thing. Now, I've talked a little bit about teaching and some of the things that support workers do. But one thing I found while I was up in PNG teaching, now teaching is my job, I'm a teacher, so it's very easy to be up there and just teach. It's your job, you know. Yes, it's a Christian school, so I have opportunities to share things about my faith, which might not be able to do quite as easily back here in Australia. But to me, I found that my ministry, you know, everyone needs to have a ministry, whether it's whatever it is. I found that my ministry wasn't ending up actually being the children I was talking to all the time. I found that there was youth pastors up there, and there was quite a good network for the kids. And I found myself drawn to some activities that were sort of beyond just Ukarumpa and that sort of thing. And just a few of the things that I really got a heart for. One of them was visiting the jails. I got involved with prison fellowship up there. And I just, the Lord sort of brought a group of us together who started praying for the people in the prisons, and we went out and visited them. And it's amazing going to a Papua New Guinean prison. There is actually one that's only about a bit over an hour's walk from where we live. And you go in there and about a third of the people come to your Bible study. And I thought, I'm sure that doesn't happen in Australia. And they are so happy to see you. They want to shake your hand for a bit longer. Sometimes they want to hug you, and they're just so glad to see you, because there's Christians in the prisons. They may have done things that were wrong. That's absolutely true. But a lot of people, you know, prison is an opportunity that God has to sort of corner them for a while and get them to have a look at their lives. And you know, one of my dreams is that some of those people in prison, who might be quite bad rascals, because you're probably all aware of the deteriorating sort of situation up in Papua New Guinea. Some of those people, they might come to Christ. And there have been people come to Christ. And that they might lead the way, and in that way the whole country, in fact, might change. And one of the other things I really, really enjoyed while I was up there was showing the Jesus video. And I'll talk a little bit about that, because it's a bit of a passion. But when a translator finishes translating into the heart language of somebody, what they often go on to next is they go and make the Jesus video, okay, which a lot of you have probably seen. It's based on the Gospel of Luke. And they put that into the heart language. So it's not in Pidgin or English or anything like that. It's in their own language. And they use this as a sort of a tool to get people interested, I guess. And, you know, you have the same sort of problems that Armin was mentioning in a lot of places, and Brian was mentioning, that, you know, people are illiterate, so seeing a video is a fantastic way of them hearing it and understanding. And so for a lot of these people, it's the first time they ever see any sort of film or anything, but anything in their own language. And it just happens to be the Jesus video. And we think that's a fantastic opportunity. So often on the weekend, we'd pack up a four-wheel drive with the video equipment, and we'd be, have been invited out to a village somewhere, and we'd take off, and we'd go to spend the night in the village. We tried not to travel like this, but that's how a lot of people travel. In fact, I have travelled like that, but I carried a group of Papua New Guineans up a mountain once, and the car was so full that I had to stop and tell them all to get out and walk up to the top of the mountain, and I'd pick them up at the top of the mountain and take them down to the side. But, you know, once you get into the villages, everyone wants to be on your car. And the terrain is very interesting. This is the main highway, called the Kathan Pass. I must tell you, I cheated a little bit with that picture, and I actually shrunk it by about 10% that way, just to make it look a bit better than it really is. But I told you, so it doesn't matter. But it is steep. Those who've been to PNG will know. And the roads are very interesting. Potholes you can drive your car down into and out of again. The Australian government spends about $300 million a year on Papua New Guinea. So in fact, as Australians, we do have a very, very close link, and they recognise that too. You know, they really recognise Australians. I don't know where all the money goes. It doesn't seem to go on roads. As you can see, this is a bridge just outside of where we live. Once you get off the main highway, this is how you travel. It rains sometimes every day, so you're never short of a good chance at doing some four-wheel driving. Once you get there, you're usually greeted in a very friendly manner. These guys were friendly. They were just pretending. Otherwise the arrow might be pointing straight at the camera. This is a village very close to where we live. Usually they are so happy to see you that they'll feed you, and they feed you under with a muumuu under the ground, dig a big hole, and steaming up lots of cow, which is wax. Well, it is sweet potato, but it's definitely different to what we eat here. When I got back to Australia, I got some sweet potato here, and I decided I'll put it in the pot and boil it up. You know what I noticed? The sweet potato here floats. Over in Papua New Guinea, it sinks. There must be something more to it. So this is the kind of excitement that people have over the video. The whole village will come and watch. And they are fascinated, and they sit there and they watch. And sometimes you can get to the end of the video and they'll say, "Can you play it through again?" So you'd spend sort of start at say 6 o'clock at night, sing some songs and, you know, pray and talk, and then you do the video, and you'd often be there till 12 or 1 at night, and then you go back into the village. And of course I was still learning pidgin at that stage, and that you'd still communicate and learn a lot of things, and my pidgin got reasonably good, so my wife tells me by the end of a couple of years up at PNG. The biggest trip we did with the Jesus video was a trip down to a place near Popondetta, which was near the northern end of the Kokoda Trail. And we spent about 9 days in this one particular language group called the Omi people. And we moved from village to village there. And it was quite an experience. We had to do lots of river crossings, like this sort of thing, carrying the video equipment with us, but in the end it was all worthwhile. It was actually quite difficult because we had people dying while we were there, and this really perplexed us. All up in the 2 weeks, including before and after while we were there, we had 8 people actually died, which was much more than what would normally happen in a time period like that. One of the people I was with was particularly worried that they may be superstitious and associate those deaths with us. But anyway, after we finished, we got back to Ukarampur, we received word that the elders of the different villages had sat down and they talked about the message that they'd seen on the video. And they said, well, look, all we've seen in our village in the last however long is death, and Jesus is the one that gives us life. So they knew that, and they talked about changing their ways. So that was pretty encouraging, but such a remote place that my heart just doesn't know, you know, you just want to go back and find out how things are going. We have one or two contacts, but we don't really know how things are going. And one of the big things that touched me during that time was not just the need for showing the Jesus video, but the need for real discipleship. And, you know, how can you do real discipleship if they haven't got a Bible and if they can't read? And that really touched me and actually got me thinking about what other roles there might be when we go back to PNG. So there's some other possibilities there as well as teaching when we go back. But we just wait and see what the Lord does. The moment he's called me to teaching, so that's great. The end goal is for all translators, for all support workers, is to see Papua New Guineans with Bibles in their own language and able to read them. Okay, just briefly, our plans are to go back very early next year, and we hope to be there to start a new semester off at the school. We're currently in the process of getting a partnership team together, people who will support us in all kinds of ways. We are getting very close. We're getting close. I might say very close. To the amount of pledged money and amount of prayer support that we need to go back there. So that's encouraging. But we're not there yet. Something to pray about. Just a couple of prayer points. We were kept in Rockhampton a bit. We're from Rockhampton at the moment. We've been kept up there a bit longer than we originally thought we'd be, but the Lord has provided us a house up there, so we bought a house that we can rent out when we go back overseas. So thanks God for that. And like I said before, continue to pray that God can raise up a partnership team. Because when we go back this time, it's not just for 2 years. It's our career. Thank you.